Thank you, Terry. Recording has started. You may now begin.
Thank you. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, and welcome to the third GNSOE PDP team meeting taking place on August the 9th, 2018 at 1300 UTC for 2 hours. In the interest of time, there will be no roll call. Attendance will be taken by the Adobe Connect room. If you are only on the telephone bridge, could you please let yourselves be known now? Hearing no one, we have listed apologies from Bargain Abadi and Milton Mueller from the NCSG and Giorgio Salintas from the GAC. They have formally assigned Colin Curry, Tatiana Tropina, and Chris Lewis Evans as their alternates for this call and any remaining days of absence. Thomas Rickert of the ISPCP has sent his apologies without assigning an alternate. During this period, the members will have only read-only rights and no access to conference calls. Their alternates will have posting rights and access to conference calls until the members' return date. As a reminder, the alternate assignment must be formalized by the way of the Google assignment form, and the link is available in the agenda pod to your right. Statements of interest must be kept up to date. If anyone has any updates to share, please raise your hand or speak up now. Seeing or hearing no one, if you need assistance updating your statement of interest, please email the GNSO Secretariat. All documents and information can be found on the EPDP Wiki space, and there is an audio cast for non-members to follow the call. So please remember to state your name before speaking. Recordings will be circulated on the mailing list and posted on the public Wiki space shortly after the end of the call. Thank you very much, and I'll turn it back over to our chair, Kurt Pritz. Please begin.
Thanks very much, and thanks, everyone, for being on the call for a timely start. So I've got my dog-eared copy of the temporary specification in my left hand and the spreadsheet that Barry Cobb and ICANN staff have put together that summarizes all your comments on my laptop as well as this page. So I'm ready to go. Just a couple administrative announcements before we start, and then we'll repeat them at the end. We're getting close on deciding on off-site meeting location and time, but not ready to announce, but hope to get through that today. So look for an announcement today so you can plan your travel. And for those of us who haven't traveled on ICANN's dime before or for a long time, we'll include some details about how to go about arranging that travel. And then there's been questions on the list. You know, we rejiggered the schedule for submitting survey comments. So on the third survey, the third quadrant, we'd like those submitted by Wednesday, and this is in writing in the slides, on Wednesday, August 15th at the close of business. So essentially 1900 UTC would be great. So that's the only thing I have on administrative things. I'll tell you that about 3 o'clock in the morning, I'm laying there thinking about this, which is a pretty sad commentary, and on how this is going. And, you know, we're all concerned about timeline and watching the progress of this triage step in the first day. I had some thoughts. So one big idea that I haven't completely fleshed out in my mind, but I want to kind of prep you for, is that, you know, we continue this triage effort because we're required to, and also there's great utility to it. But we could continue this sort of offline. That is, you continue fleshing out the survey, and our staff support takes that on board, summarize that. We write an issue summary and plug it into a triage report for your review. So we could sort of do this offline and dive into the part of the substantive discussion where we're actually debating the merits of the and the possible changes to the temporary specification, you know, as early as next week. So let's see how this meeting goes and how far we get through this work, and then I'll write up my thoughts. and send them around to you. But I just wanted you to kind of understand where I'm coming from, that, you know, we can't afford this of the 10 weeks we have. We really can't afford to spend a month on the triage part of it. You know, I realize, though, that, you know, I personally think this triage portion of it has considerable value. So it's sort of a balancing of whether we want to, you know, restart and get into some final decision making, or we want to continue with the triage. So I hope that was somewhat coherent. And later today, I'll try to make that more clear in an email to you. So before we get into the substance, are there any comments on anything I've said so far, or does any points of order, or does anybody want to bring anything else up? Okay, great. So I'm going to try to do a better job of not monitoring the chat. So, I certainly have that your comments on board. Bruce and also Aiden. So today we're reviewing sections where there's somewhat more agreement on them. So I want to try to conduct the discussion in a slightly different way, and in the way I described during our very first meeting about essentially going around the room, and that might get us through the material faster. So we'll give this a try and see how that goes. Of course, anybody raising their hand at any time will, you know, get the ability to speak. We've seen the beautiful red and green chart that's a little more red than, well, I had hoped, but nonetheless is very instructive. And I think, you know, in the paper that I've started, that's going to be the triage document, I'm going to point out that even where there's green, the green often indicates that the sentiment of the section is agreed to, but there's still some edits suggested. So, you know, universally, we're going to have to discuss each section and decide on the final wording of that. So with that, I want to get into where we left off and the substantive discussion of the temporary specification. And we left off with starting with section 4.47, the famous section 4.4 at SEC. And let's see if this is helpful or not. One is, so the first one is 4.4.7, you know, enabling the publication of technical administrative points of contact, administrating the uses of data, administrating the domain name holder at the request of the registered name. So I note that in that section, just the registrars and ISPs have objected to this. The registries did too, but on the basic ground that we need to revisit this entire section due to the recent input that ICANN's received. So does somebody from the registrars and the ISPs, can you read the issue summary, and does that sort of capture your issue? And even if you question the utility of the voluntary data submission, you know, adding the administrative and technical contact, does that rise to the level of objecting to make it voluntary? So I'd like to hear from somebody, either from the registrars or the internet service providers. Thanks, Emily. Go ahead, please.
Hi. I can take a swing at it, and then no doubt colleagues can correct me or add or disagree. I think that it was not so much questioning the voluntary nature of these, but just to say that, you know, these technical and administrative points of contact are now a sort of relic from a former age, and it's very hard to justify on the data minimization principle in the GDPR the collection and let alone other processing of these data. I mean, on the last call, in the chat, I think we were hearing from some law enforcement colleagues who were like, yeah, we never use these. And that would be the only possible justification that I could think of. But really, these, you know, so if we're thinking about how to fit the collection of these data into a GDPR compliant framework, we're really struggling. That was where I think we were coming from, but obviously other colleagues may well have further comments to make on that. So I hope that's clear, and I'm very happy to clarify any points in my statement.
Kurt, if you're speaking, you're muted.
All right, so I understand, but it kind of says that you think the utility of the information is outweighed by some other interests. You know, okay. So all of a sudden, I'm very concerned that I've just focused on one item, and we have a couple other people in this. Go ahead, Emily.
Oh, sorry. I think it's a bit stronger than questioning the utility of the voluntary data submission. It's actually more a question that we don't think it can possibly comply with the data minimization principles in the GDPR. So it's a stronger,
right. So
rather
I think
than like, yeah. Oh, you know. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. So I think Alex put it well that your objective, the collection of data, because it's the minimization principle, not the voluntary collection, not that it's voluntary. Caboose?
Yes. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. In view of the limited time available, I think perhaps, Kurt, you may need to revisit the method of work of the team. Your earlier message indicate that the answer should have some rationale. I think for yes, we could have two possibilities, absolute yes or yes with some qualifiers. But for no, I think people, when they say no, they should include the rationale for no. In that case, you don't need to ask them at the meeting to explain why they say no, unless for you and others the rationale is not clear. Therefore, you can gain some time for that. This would help everybody to understand. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much, Kavus. Mark, that's a good comment.
Mark Schlesierik for the record. I've seen a number of comments saying that these fields are historical relics. And I just wonder, how do the registries know that, actually? I mean, you wouldn't be contacted on these email addresses. Microsoft makes the affirmative to supply different addresses. Well, I think our registrar and admin are the same, and then our technical contact is different. And people contact us on these addresses. And I, for one, you know, had to do a Whois lookup last year because I got a Christmas gift that didn't work. I went to their website, and it was down on Christmas Day. And so I went to Whois, got their technical contact, emailed their technical contact. The next day, their website was back up, and I got my software. So in my personal experience, that, you know, as an employee of Microsoft and as just a user of the Internet, the technical and admin contact field seem like they still have utility, at least in some cases. I'm just wondering, how would the registry know that those fields are no longer in use?
Okay, I think I think we've pinpointed the issue there. I think we have the basis for carrying it forward. So, Margie, that was something else different from us?
Yeah, this is Margie. I also wanted to point out that the ICANN policies themselves have different roles and responsibilities related to those contacts. And so we have consensus policies that have been developed over the last, 10-plus years. The transfer policy, the transfer dispute resolution policy, the who is data reminder policy, UDRP, and there's different roles that are specified for policy reasons for those contacts. So I think that's just further support for why this is not an exercise of collecting more data than is necessary. This is actually data that's used to satisfy the ICANN policies.
Thanks, Margie. I'm just reading into the chat. So, thanks very much for that, James.
Thanks, Kurt. I believe Mark was ahead of me in the queue.
Oh, I thought he already spoke. Yeah. Well, I have a tradition
of skipping
over for Mark. No, he had already spoke.
So, just to a little bit of color. Commentary to this topic, and thanks to Mark and Margie for raising their points. It is correct to note that that the ICANN policies do define some functions, mostly for the administrative contact, and mostly in those cases to establish that the administrative contact is equivalent to the registrant contact for certain functions like transfers, or to establish that it is subservient to the registrant contact in the event of a transfer dispute between the registrant and the admin. So there are some defined roles in the policies that are relative to the role of the registrant. But I think the stepping back from the ICANN rule book and just looking at the law, we found that for some registrars, we're somewhere north of 90 to 95% duplication across all of these contacts. So I think while Mark's point is valid in specific situations, for the vast majority of domain names, the contacts, the four contacts, admin, tech, billing, and registrant are the same. And that, as Emily points out, starts to raise questions of why are we collecting all of this duplicate information and sharing this duplicate information in, and how does that square with data minimization? And then there is also, and I think Alex put some notes in the chat, there is also a problem of tracking consent when those contacts are different. It's easier for, I think in Mark's situation, if it's a company and you're saying, Becky is in charge of admin and Charlie is in charge of technical and Frank is in charge of billing. And I think that's one way to define it. But when it's an individual collecting information on other individuals and not an organizational contact, then it raises the question of how did the registrant obtain and share consent to publication for those other individuals. And I think that's just raising our level of discomfort with tracking this information, which has, except for certain edge cases, and certainly in less than 10% of domain names, it has a limited utility. So I think that's where we arrived at this. I'm probably speaking generally for all registrars, which is probably stretching the generic case into a registrar-specific position, but I think ultimately that's kind of how we arrived at this response.
Thanks, James. I think I have a clear picture for how to frame this up for a final discussion. So that was a really helpful discussion. To move a tiny bit faster, I want to take sections 4.4.8 and 4.4.9 9 together. The latter has to do with providing framework for an access for access to appropriate law enforcement needs, and the former has to do with providing a framework for issues involving consumer protection, investigation of cybercrime, DNS abuse, and intellectual property protection. And in the case of that one, 4.4.8, it was generally felt that this section isn't appropriately detailed, adequately describe the issue. And so when I read this issue, I took it as sort of a pointer to other things. So the framework, the framework might well be the access model if developed, when developed, and the rules surrounding that. So and so the requirement is that for an access model, which is a framework, the requirement here is a commitment to support a framework when that's developed. So that's how I took it, but that took a lot of reading and thinking about it, and I'm sympathetic to the fact that for maybe the biggest issue in the whole paper, that's a few lines. And then in law enforcement, there was a discussion we've already had that Article 6 of the GDPR doesn't require this balancing, and that's the issue there. But there were several parties, disagreeing with these sections, the GAC, registrars, internet service providers, and the registry. So I'd like to hear from them first. But the question is, do these issue summaries capture that issue, or can you put a better point on the issue? I went to management training class many years ago and was taught that silence is a powerful tool. So if somebody wants to speak to the very simple question of whether these issue summaries have captured the issues you've raised or not, that'd be good rather than discussing the big, broad substance of it. Thanks, Chris. Go ahead, please.
Thanks, Kurt. I think the issue summaries collect our points. I think there's general agreement from the GAC on 4.4.8 and 4.4.9. It's just some of the language that needs changing slightly and describing the situation slightly better. So that's, I think, our main concern with that. But the issue summary captures that, I think. Thank you.
Amr?
Thanks, Kurt. This is Amr. The NCSG
Amr, go ahead, please.
Did. Yeah, thanks. Can you hear me? Hello?
Yeah, we can hear you.
All right, great. Thanks. The NCSG did put its response to the survey question on 4.4.8 as we do agree, but we did, as Cavus suggested earlier, we did put a little qualifier in there, or maybe not so much a qualifier, but just a suggestion. As you mentioned, Kurt, earlier, we will obviously get to the question of detailing a framework for access to the data, but one of the slight issues we hadn't discussed here on 4.4.8 was really pinpointing who the actors with legitimate interests might be here. So identifying consumer protection, investigation of cybercrime, serious organized crime, DNS abuse, and intellectual property protection at this point we believe may be a little premature, just in terms of our discussion, not that we're at this time opposed to any or all of these purposes for processing data and having access to it. But at this time, since we haven't gotten to the framework, and since we really haven't discussed in detail ICANN's mission in processing data, collecting it, and processing it in any other form, we did propose a replacement text and sort of replacing all these specific purposes with something like enabling verified and authorized third parties, if any, to request relevant data from registrars and registries in a secure manner to address issues involving domain name registrations. So we feel this gives a blanket sort of statement in that, you know, anyone who is eventually verified and authorized, any third party, that they would be able to request this data from contracted parties. Thanks.
Thanks, that was a good comment. And I have a question for the registrars about that too, but Stephanie, you're in the queue first.
Thanks very much, Stephanie Perrin, for the record. Just a query about this summary under 4.4.9, the suggestion that law enforcement access to personal data needn't pass the balancing. Law enforcement access to data has to pass constitutional protections, and there is regularly a balancing going on. It seems to me that this, and much in line with what Amr just said about other actors, it seems to imply that law enforcement requests are always, I don't like to use the word legitimate, because I'm not trying to imply that law enforcement actors are not in the habit of acting in good faith. But there are plenty of arguments between data protection authorities and law enforcement over the proportionality of their requests, the manner of them, the detailed nature of the investigation, et cetera. And I think that this summary, while probably accurate, seems to leave us with the impression that this is true. And I'm sure somebody commented to this effect, but that doesn't make it correct. Thanks.
Thanks, Stephanie. As someone with some experience as a criminal defense attorney, I'm really familiar with the limits or not limits placed on law enforcement, and I think an important side effort that needs to go on is that if the if this sort of balancing is not required by Article 6, how does the law enforcement requests occur? I think that's good. I think so. A question I had for registrars was, I have to bring up the page again, but the registrar said the following should be struck: consumer protection, intellectual property protection is there outside of ICANN scope. So from the registrars, does Amr's comment kind of ring true that there might be, there's ways to accomplish these goals, but we shouldn't be saying they're within ICANN's remit, but rather just putting that a different way. So, and rewording the text along those lines does your objection sort of line up with Amr's statement? I asked that question clearly. It was a lot clearer in my mind than it came out of my mouth. Matt, you're the author, claimed author of the registrar comments. Does your comment here like line up with what Amr said, or are you making a different point?
Kurt, can you hear me?
Yep, I can.
Cool. Yes, I think it does. I think just to be clear, where we were coming from and the feedback we got from registrars in general was the concern really was around getting into content, which obviously is something that historically registrars have voiced concern about in terms of being outside of ICANN's remit. So yes, I think that pretty much summarizes where we were coming from with those comments on 4.4.8.
Okay, great. If no one else has, so I have enough information to touch this up and kind of put the, you know, there's two purposes to this, right? One is to do this triage report, and the other is to frame up the issues for the next next go around. Margie, do you have your hand up?
Yes, this is Margie. I wanted to just comment on the statement that it's outside of ICANN's remit to address IP concerns, and I think we fundamentally disagree with that. Obviously, the UDRP is an ICANN policy. There's a distinction between content and domain name related disputes that have IP implications. And so I just want to flag that there's a disagreement on that, particularly from the BC, because the UDRP is one of the most important policies that's come out of ICANN, and that's clearly an intellectual property related protection.
Right. So, I'm wondering, but I don't want to try to lead to a conclusion, but I think everybody agrees with the premise that you stated and are concerned how to put that in the right way. So that's a good comment. Benedict, how are you?
Can you hear me okay?
Yes, thank you. Go ahead, Benedict.
Hiya, can you hear me now?
Yes, I can. Thank you.
Oh, great. Sorry. Just to draw your attention to the what was called Spec 11 for the new GTLD contracts. It's now called the Framework for Registry Operator to Respond to Security Threats, and that defines some of the threats that were agreed to be in scope when we last looked at security and what security threats we might consider be in scope and out of scope. And the list, you guys can Google. I haven't got the link in front of me, but Framework for Registry Operator to respond to security threats. What was considered to be in scope was phishing, malware distribution, and botnets. I think spamming was left out after lots of discussion. So that was seen as the sort of core cybercrime protection of DNS issues. Thank you.
Thanks, Annette. And that sort of is the dividing. Okay, I got it. Sorry. Alex?
Yeah, it's Alex Deakin. Just on this issue of content, again, I'm looking at some of the clarifications in the chat, which is helpful. But I just wanted to remind everyone, for those of us who were involved or watching, the transition process, we discussed kind of the scope and mission of ICANN at great lengths, ended up in the new set of bylaws. I just want to make sure we don't use this working group to kind of re-debate and reopen that decision or where we ended up there. I think that would be a mistake. Thanks.
Thanks, Alex. All right. So I'm gonna march on to for the next topics, and I have to bundle a couple of them. So because I think they're related. So if you look at, and if I was smarter, I would have organized the slides a little better. But 4.4.10 has to do with facilitating the provision of zone files of GTLDs for internet users. And, you know, so my questions really, and our questions really went to, you know, what's the distinction between a zone file and registration data? You know, the zone file contains IP addresses, the name of the registrar, the domain name. So I don't know why this was here, and, you know, perhaps some others can shed some light on that. And then in the next topics, 4.4.10 is what happened? All right, 4.4.11 is, you know, providing mechanisms for safeguarding registered name holders' registration data in the event of a business technical failure. 4.4.12 has to do with coordinating dispute resolution, which was widely agreed to, and 4.4.13 has to do with handling contractual compliance requests. So, you know, again, the registrars objected to these, and sort of alone in some cases, but I think there's a really valid about the use of different data, and something I came to understand, you know, only after several years of being at ICANN. So I want to hear from them, but also, there's a few others that objected to these, the ISPs and others. So Benedict, do you want to start on this topic?
Hey, I'm really sorry. I was actually wanting to make one comment on 4410. Excuse me, 449 on law enforcement access before we moved on. Would that be okay, or do you want to take that at the end of the call, Kurt?
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
As some people on the call know, I worked in law enforcement doing this kind of access to data work in the UK, and essentially. To sort of framework our thinking, there is data that law enforcement can require, so legally require, of organizations, and generally that's limited to the jurisdiction they're in. And there's some work in the EU to fix that, so that you can sort of cross borders within the European Union, but essentially there is no way for a law enforcement agency to go beyond its own borders, right? It's a really old-fashioned kind of 19th century model of country sovereignty. Law enforcement doesn't have any power outside of its own borders. It can't be considered to be anything other than some guy asking. So I'd like you to think about outside of your borders, it may be somebody in a uniform, but it's just some guy asking. So there's no special status for law enforcement. On the other hand, and what increasingly the tech industry has started doing, is to say we recognize unilaterally the right of law enforcement in other countries to ask for certain kinds of data that are not in breach, that we can give them. So, for example, Facebook, based in the US, can give data to UK law enforcement as long as they're not breaching local Californian privacy laws. So there is a smaller subset of data. It's not everything. It's certainly not intrusive kind of data, but basic what's called basic subscriber information in law enforcement parlance, that they are not prohibited from handing over to law enforcement that they choose to recognize in other countries. And Internet and Jurisdiction Projects is working a lot on this kind of area. So what I'd really like to do is consider this, or like to at least suggest to the group that we consider that area and not this sort of halfway house, and not the what Lauren, the sort of Michele, what we've referred to previously as the Michele view, which is I'll only hand over stuff to a court order from the Garda in Ireland. So I think that's the bit that ICANN's purview when we're thinking about a framework for law enforcement access. I appreciate that this might be contentious, and so I'm sorry that if I've thrown a sort of spanner in the works here. Thank you.
Yeah, so I have several thoughts on how to carry that discussion forward, but I think we'll wait for when we get into that specifically with the objective of approving it, disapproving it, or changing it. So, but I think it was really helpful. Caboose?
Yes, I hope that the Secretariat has duly captured exactly what was said by the commenter, which will help us, because in one of the member of the GACS views, it was also implicitly referred to that. But my request for comment is not this, is that I reiterate that in the paragraph 4.4, there are several one area referred reliable mechanism and the other area talking of mechanism, and I would like to have a clearance whether it is an oblique or whether something the other mechanisms is not considered to be reliable. Thank you.
Thank you, Caboose. I think that's right, and I appreciated your comment earlier about going back to the drafter of these of the temporary specification and asking some specific questions. Tatiana?
Thank you very much. Hi, everyone. Tatiana Tropina for the record. I want to address what, I'm sorry, Benedict just said about law enforcement and ongoing work and voluntary collaboration and sharing the data. I'm speaking from the point of view of someone who is working in the field of mutual legal assistance in my daily job. And I think that while those initiatives of Facebook to provide subscriber data are certainly appreciated by law enforcement agencies, first of all, they are not legally supported in every country. Some countries prohibit this voluntary collaboration, even if it is very good for law enforcement. But I think that in this case, in our case of GDPR and law enforcement access to data, ICANN cannot fix the problem of mutual legal assistance and handling data cross-border. And if ICANN will take this kind of voluntary steps and obliging registries and registrars to do anything, this will mean that ICANN will conflate its purpose, lawful purpose for processing data, with lawful purpose of requesting and processing data of third parties. And this is exactly what European Data Protection Board told ICANN not to do in the letter. So would really like to have it on the record, while I'm sure that it's bona fide from Benedict and others to propose this, I do believe that this is pure conflating the purposes. Thank you.
Thank you, Tatiana. Let's get away from this and go on to the more mechanical ones about the use of data, the use of facilitating the provision of zone files and whether that agrees here, and providing mechanisms for safeguarding registered name holders and coordinating dispute resolution services, and finally, contractual compliance. So I saw, James, you stuck your hand up, but then you took it down. Do you want to start with that? Yes, you do.
Kurt, hi, this is Gene speaking, Mike. I was actually raising my hand to get a clarifying question from Benedict, which he responded in the chat. So I lower my hand so we can move on.
Okay, great. Well, since you're so close to the microphone, can you talk a bit about provision of zone files and whether you think that's appropriate, and then providing a mechanism in the event of business or technical failure? Plus, I think the registrars were one of the only ones to object to these, but I thought there was a valid argument to be made.
So thanks, and I think Emily wants to address as well. I know that we had some questions and concerns regarding zone files and the relevance to whether or not they contained personal information and whether they were subject to all of this. I think that there are separate processes for displaying and making that data available. And the other question was for technical or business failure. I think we note that we have the escrow provisions for that purpose. And so that this seems to be a conflating of two different purposes. But I wasn't close to the drafting of the response for this particular section, so I probably should stop talking now and maybe let Emily do some damage control for what I just said. Thanks.
Yeah, that's right. Thanks, James. Go ahead, Emily. Thank you.
I think that none of us are saying these aren't valid purposes, but we do question what they're doing in a WHOIS specification. So provision of zone files to GTLD, GTLD zone files to internet users, fine, but what's it doing here? And the data escrow is the mechanism that is used in the event of business or technical failure. And so it was just really questioning what these, what the relationship these provisions have to the public who is, or even who is data. So it's really actually agreeing with James what he was saying.
So I think that everybody agrees that zone file access should be made available and that there should be mechanisms safeguarding registered name holders' data in the event of a business technical failure, but that what you're saying is that's not a reason for processing data, especially making that data public, so especially in the case of, data escrow. So that sort of resonated with me. Does anybody have a comment in return to any of that? I noticed that the internet service providers also objected to the zone file data. Ashley, how are you?
Good. How are you doing? So I just want to raise a question here that I think has been raised a number of times in different contexts, but applies here as well to a certain extent, which is we're kind of all looking at these questions as collection only, which I realize is part of processing, but there's other aspects of processing as well. So I don't have strong views on this particular example, but it's a good example. Is it still necessary to have this purpose and lawfulness language here, because there are other activities outside the collection? While there may not be a purpose necessary for the collection, but you still would need a purpose for other issues involved in processing. So therefore, you still need the language here, such as the disclosure aspect of the zone files or making any changes to the zone file information that requires having this language here. So I'm articulating this question sufficiently, because it's just kind of a fundamental question that seems to be kind of popping up everywhere. Thanks.
You know, Ashley, I think somebody made a really similar comment in the last meeting, and that is categorize these this processing into their appropriate columns, whether it's collection, use, or disclosure. And so, maybe there's a clear case where, we collect the registration data for the purpose of safeguarding, but we don't otherwise use or disclose it. Emily, that's a new hand, right?
Yes, sorry to ask for the microphone again. I just wanted to see if I can respond to Ashley's question. And I think I might have been responsible for making that distinction between collection and different forms of processing. I think that if you don't collect that, obviously you can't do anything with it subsequently. But part of the justification for collecting data would be thinking all the way through all of the different reasons why it might be useful or valid or necessary, or there might be legitimate reasons for doing something with it later down the line. If you can't actually answer that question in the in the affirmative, then you shouldn't be collecting it in the first place. So collection is important as a sort of threshold issue. I hope that clarifies the point. I certainly, from my perspective, wouldn't say we should only be thinking about collection, absolutely not, but we should be viewing it as a threshold. If you can't justify why it would come in useful, or it's actually a much stricter test than that, if it wouldn't be necessary or legitimate reasons for collecting it, then you shouldn't be collecting it in the first place. I hope that clarifies the point for Ashley. Thank you.
Yeah, and you did a much better job than I did. If you collect it, then you have to have a use or a reason for disclosing it. If you don't have one of those two, then there's not really a reason for collecting it. So I think that's well put. Of ICANN compliance collection of data, are there any comments? So I, reading the comments, I didn't see an objection to ICANN what's the word I'm looking for? Anyway, done in a narrow way that only accomplishes what needs to be accomplished. So in the pantheon of inarticulateness, that will go at the top. But can anybody flesh out what the reasons for ICANN compliance having access to data, you know, disclosing data to ICANN for doing their job? Any comments?
Hello, may I make my comment?
Go ahead.
Can you hear me?
I can't hear you yet.
Yes. My comment was in the chat. The collection of data is something, but disclosure of that to public is something else. So we need to clarify the scope of the disclosure. Thank you.
Sorry, I didn't hear you. I think you're cutting out. Can you hear me?
I think hearing me. Can you hear me?
Now I can. Yeah, I couldn't hear you before. So the issue related to compliance has to do with being able to actually do the investigation needed for a compliance action. And so if you can imagine, there's all kinds of things that the compliance department does, one of them being who is accuracy follow-up or who is access follow-up, in addition to all the audits that they do for their contractual contracts with the registrars and registries. So there's a broad array of uses for who is as it relates to the compliance activity of ICANN, and it's really important for ICANN to be able to have that access to effectively do their job.
Yeah, and I think what we'll ask them is to specify what that job is so that we can, you know, it can be acknowledged that that overcomes the duty that is, you know, to overcome the rights of individuals. So it's a legitimate purpose of overcoming the rights of individuals. So I'm going to switch over to my phone. I hope this works. Can you guys hear me?
Hi, Kurt. Yes. We certainly can.
You guys hear me?
Yes, we can hear you. You may want to mute your speakers.
Okay. I'm just reading the comments. Hang on. Okay, has anybody else got their hand raised on this? I don't think 4.11 captures our concerns, which is that the response to business tech failure is handled. Yeah, so that's what I thought. So can you, Emily, can you just talk to that? That 4.4.1 does the mechanism.
Sure.
Go ahead.
Is it 4.4.11?
Yes, sorry.
Or was it 4.4.13? So I think it's just that, so we're looking at, does the issue summary capture the disagreement or lack of consensus? I think that it's not quite getting there because we're saying that the response to business and technical failure of a contracted party is actually handled by a separate mechanism from who is. So it's not relevant.
And could you flesh that out a little bit more?
I don't think the... I'm reading all the 4.4 sub-clauses as itemizing processing that is done in relation to who is data. And so I'm sort of querying, I think we're querying, why who is data is relevant and why it's included here. But I can also see that James is coming to my rescue here. He could probably flesh that out a bit more clearly than I can.
Thanks, James. Good handoff, Emily.
Thanks, and I don't know if I'm going to be all that helpful, but I think one of the, counterexamples that exists for any claim that who is data is necessary for business or technical failure is the fact that industries like .com are often the subject of a registrar failure, and we use the escrow system and the escrow deposits to recover the registration data that's associated with any failure of a registrar that's been either gone under or gone dark or been deaccredited. So I think that is a clear example of why or a case study of why this who is data is not necessary to support this purpose and why this purpose can be served by a different process, being the ESCO process, and it's really just not relevant to this work.
But just for my understanding, James, because isn't the escrow process escrowing the who is data?
It's escrow. It is escrowing. I would say it is escrowing a subset and a superset of the registration data.
That's available to a registrar through means other than the who is database?
Some of the information that is included in escrow deposits is not published in Whois.
Okay. Margie? Thanks, James. And Emily.
Sure, this is Margie. I think it's James's comments really aren't applicable in this case because the Whois data is something that isn't accessible for consumers. When a registrar goes out of business or has some event, yes, it's true that at some point there will be a transfer to a new registrar and that Whois data and other data that's in escrow will be transferred to their new registrar, but there could be a gap depending upon what's the situation going on with that particular registrar. Where the consumer needs to be able to confirm the details of their registration, and that's where Whois plays a really important consumer protection role. So it is true, yes, that the escrow service provides that need, but it's not a need that can be accessed by consumers, and consumers have no right to access that data. It's only when the information is transferred to the new registrar, that the escrow information is, you know, can is helpful and can re-establish the who is connection.
Thanks, Margie. Alan?
Thank you. I must have been, I'm a little bit confused. I thought we were talking about processing of who is data, which includes collection, and one of the reasons we collect it is so we can escrow it or provide zone files or you know, provide zone files just so the internet works. So all of these elements are being collected and published in who is and available under varying terms as we go forward. But since they're all who is elements, I thought that it is reasonable and necessary for us to list here that we are going to use them for escrow, perhaps, or zone files. So I'm not quite sure why we're saying it's not who is information and therefore doesn't belong in the who is specification at all. But maybe I'm missing something, but it seems to me as this is one of the prime reasons we're collecting this data and asking for it, and I don't see how we can omit mentioning it here. Thank you.
Mark? Thanks, Alan.
Hi, Kurt. This is Mark. And just to follow up on what Alan said, I think, you know, Alan's pointing out that we're actually having a conversation on scope. You know, what is the scope of the conversation we're having? You know, and I think, you know, the conversation around escrow sort of highlights that is, you know, are we talking about, you know, the processing of registration data, or are we talking about, you know, what's traditionally known as who is services? You know, and I think it's important that we all get on the same page as far as, you know, what exactly is in scope of these discussions, because I'm not sure we all are. And, you know, it's important that, you know, we don't end up talking past each other on some of these things. So, you know, I guess my observation is that we're dovetailing a little bit into a conversation around what is the scope of registration data services.
Right, and I think, go ahead, James.
So, thanks, James speaking, and I agree with Mark. Maybe I can help untangle this. I think we're talking past each other, as he suggests, because we are we're trying to establish the need or the purpose for collection of data, and you could, I think, clearly state that registrars must collect this data in order to complete and maintain who is escrow deposits in the event of a registrar failure. But I think where it stops is we need to publish that data in Whois in order to safeguard against a technical or a business failure. And I think what we're saying is, well, that's not necessary. We can guard against those scenarios simply by our collection and our deposits in escrow, and then that's where that train stops. It doesn't necessarily then require us to, A, share with the registries, for example, or B, publish it in Whois. It simply can be limited to collection by the registrars and deposit into the escrow system. So I think what we're doing is we're saying, like, processing as this umbrella term, but we're looking at the we're combining a number of different steps, which is processing, collection, publication, and transmission to other parties. When I think our case is in the case of a business or technical failure, it really just stops at collection and transmission to the escrow service. So I hope that helps and not make things worse.
I think so it's helpful to me, and I think what would help is some sort of write-up about that. So let me, and that, you know, defines with clarity what Whois data is collected and how that differs from the zone file and is completely separate from the zone file. And then, as you alluded to here, the information that's necessary to protect the registrant in case of a failure. Alan?
Thank you. Maybe I'm not awake yet this morning, but I'm having problems. I mean, if we collect the, you know, what DNS servers there are to put in the zone file, or collect any of the other information which today or last month goes into Whois, that information may be used for a multitude of purposes, but I don't think we can segregate the two and say, you know, if they are going into Whois, then by definition they're Whois information, and I think we're looking at different uses of it, some of which is not related to the Whois file, but it's the same information, and I'm not sure we don't collect that same information twice, because we're going to use it for some purposes related to Whois and some purposes not related to Whois. So I don't see how we have any choice but to conflate all of the uses under the rubric of it is Whois data, because among other things it does go into the Whois currently. So that I'm not sure how we can segregate the other uses and therefore say it's not Whois data when it's the same information. Thank you.
Yeah, and I think Alan, calling it registration data, you know, sort of points that up. But as James pointed out, there's data that's escrowed that's not included in the Whois data that's necessary for that data escrow function. So to a certain extent, it's separated already.
But there may be other information added in. It's not Whois data. It doesn't fall under the rubric of Whois.
Yeah, so I think we really need some sort of graphic to help us discuss this with clarity and everybody using the same terminology. So I'll combine with some registrars to put something together. Stephanie?
Stephanie Perrin, for the record, I just wanted to agree with Alan in what he's suggesting here. It seems to me that we should be clear about what our mission is. Yes, there is a temporary spec. Our main goal is to go through the temporary spec and determine whether it should become a consensus policy. One of the problems that we have not addressed is whether the temporary spec actually deals with everything that it had to deal with to ensure that ICANN, in its policy direction to contracted parties, is indeed compliant with the GDPR. And I would submit that there are some omissions here, which we need to discover as we go along, or preferably beforehand. And that if we call it registration data, then it tracks all of the data, including the data that might be generated in response to an application to register a domain name, because that becomes associated with the individual as well. And you have to consider that in a broader focus on what personal information is. So we really have to look at the RAA and which elements are within the picket fence and therefore not subject to consensus policy and which are not. So that, to me, is an operative question that we need to also focus on. Thanks.
Thanks, Stephanie. Good. Mark?
Thanks, Kurt. Mark Anderson again. Touching on a couple things, you mentioned terminology, and I think that's important here. If I can, you know, pick on Alan for a second, you know, I don't think he'll mind terribly, but, you know, he was talking about Whois data when I think like what he put, registration data. You know, Whois is, you know, it's simply, it's talking about collecting, you know, collecting Whois data for different purposes. And, you know, I think that's, just to echo Kurt's point, I think we need to make sure we're using the same terminology, again, we run the risk of talking past each other. You know, Whois is a display mechanism. You know, it's a protocol for displaying registration data. You know, registration data itself, can have other purposes. And, you know, just, you know, agreeing with the points James said earlier about those different purposes and how it's used. I think we need to be clear when we're talking about registration data and registration data services.
Thanks, Mark, and I think thanks everyone for this detailed discussion, and I think I have enough to put together a cogent description of this issue, but think too that we all have to get on the same page with respect to what's in traditional, who is, what is not, and that distinction, and how we sort of homogenize that for this, not homogenize that, but gather it all as part of registration data. Hadia, you can make the last comment on this topic. You have to come off mute. There you go.
Yeah, I just want to echo what everyone, what Maddie said, that why do we insist on calling it who is the data? What we are actually dealing with is the temporary specification for generic top-level domain registration data, and that's a great difference.
Right.
Thank you.
All right, I'm going to move on to section. So we're going to leave the section 4.4s and go on to section 4.5, which describes to me the rationale for why the listing of uses of registration data and possible disclosure in 4.4 is, well, it says in the document proportionate, but I take that as appropriate or a legitimate use that isn't overcome by the rights of individuals. And also to me, these sections in 4.5 are similar to 4.1 and through 4.3 in that they're more about rationale and justification for the direction provided in the rest of the specification. And so there's significant disagreement with regard to this section. And again, I think from previous discussion, that's why it might be better to discuss in the next go around to discuss the sections 4.4 and all the specific uses of the data, all the purposes for collecting it or processing it is the better term, all the actual data that's processed rather than the justification for it, because we'll develop in our discussion our own justifications and then can kind of either map them to this. And my final editorial comment about this section 4.5 as well as, you know, those other sections 4.1 through 4.3, you know, I wonder if they're necessary in a specification. I wonder if, they don't belong somewhere else, but you know, the specification is really kind of telling us what to do with regard to the data and doesn't necessarily require this rationale. So what comments are there on this? Caboose, could you go ahead, please?
Yes, I think some of the clarification which will be provided in section 4.4 may help to better understand in 4.5. However, there are many terms in 4.5 that need clarification. Limited personal data. I don't know what the limited means. And then we have something to other terms that unjustified processing. I don't know what unjustified processing means. So there are many things that require clarifications, and in particular 4.5.5. So I don't know whether you want to go to one by one, 4.5.1, or you want to take it all together. Thank you.
Yeah, so thanks, Caboose. I agree with what you said. And for me, that's why I'd like to kind of skip this section until we talk about 4.4 and then come back to it. I think, you know, writing, you know, such a justification might necessarily include a lot more detail, you know, explaining the terms as you mentioned, and then maybe authorities too. Amar?
Elmer, are you there?
Elmer, are you there?
No, it's not coming through, Elmer. Okay, thanks very much. Is there anything else on this issue? How should we frame this up in our triage report? If not, raise your hand again when you think we have them, or does anybody have a, they'll try again in a minute. Okay. Caboose, is that a new hand?
Hello, my comment?
Hi, Caboose. Yeah.
Yes, I agree with you that we should come back to 4.5 later on, once we have the clarification on 4.4, perhaps the 4.5 may need to be revisited and redrafted. Some of the answer may be found in 4.4. Therefore, I fully agree with you that we need not to discuss it at this stage. Just defer the discussion on that until we receive clarification on 4.4. Thank you.
Thank you, Toulouse. Right, I'm going to go on. You've got to flip pages in your temporary specification that I know you have open in front of you. And the first set of comments have to do with section one, and most of the comments had to really had to do with the search capabilities and whether or not search was required. So I think that this section raised some uncertainty about whether searchable registration data is required. So the appendix A in 1.2.1 says, where search capabilities are permitted and offered, the registry operator registrar must do these things. So it's kind of a oddly put thing because it doesn't say search capabilities are required. So that kind of obviates the need for the must. But the way they've captured that is in what I've written here. There's some uncertainty as to whether search capability should be a contractual requirement and whether such a provision such as Section 1 is required at all given the current contract that we already have to collect this information. So the issue that people have raised that is that if you strip out the search capability comment that this is already redundant with what exists in the contract. Is that a fair characterization of the issue for this Appendix A? Mark?
Hey, Kurt. It's Mark Anderson. Let me take a stab at this one. And the first thing I'll say is just sort of to confirm what you said is that, search capabilities, are not required for all registries, but some new GTLD registry contracts in their Exhibit A, include language requiring the support for search. So, the search capability, isn't required for all, but it was a feature in some of the new GTLD registry agreements. And then the other thing I want to say, and this is, I'm going to quote a little bit here from the registry stakeholder group response to this question, and that's basically that, in case in the base registry agreement, it already includes language which we think is sufficient. And here it says, the registry operator will implement appropriate measures to avoid abuse of this feature being searchable.
permitting access only to legitimate authorized users and ensure the feature is in compliance with any applicable privacy laws or policies. And so, you know, the language in the temporary specification, in our view, is unnecessary, and it's actually more burdensome to implement than the existing base registry agreement language. You know, so, well, I think this temporary specification language is probably, you know, well-intended. You know, it's maybe not necessary here. So hopefully I've done a sufficient job of representing the registry stakeholder review of this one. Christina Allen could correct me if I've got anything wrong there.
Thanks, Mark. So I was going to reiterate what you said, but I don't see the need to. Benedict?
From chatting to law enforcement, I think this is probably, search is really important to them, and probably more important, I would hazard, than the actual underlying data, which can always be obtained under court order, so outside this process. But search and the ability to pivot off a search, let's say, for an identifier, even if that identifier is anonymized. So, like, let's take a hash of an email address, put it in and tell me what other domains that registrant owns, that sort of pivotability, that sort of advanced search, if you like, is probably more important to LE and cybercrime fighters than actually getting the person's data for the purposes of this discussion. And that's probably going to be a red line for LE here, but Chris Lewis-Evans is on the call, who actually still works at LE, unlike me, who hasn't worked there for years. Thank you.
Thanks, Benedict. Alex has a question. Does the registry agreement require the functionality or just allow it? So my recollection, and somebody correct me, was that during the new GTLD application process, the applicants got an extra point if they furnished searchable who is. So it was taken advantage of by some, and so it's in their registry agreements, but not by others. And it was not a requirement before that. Is that, can I ask Mark or somebody else to verify whether I'm correct or not? Or any, are you guys, like James, are you raising your hand to answer that question or another one?
This is Mark. I'm happy to jump in.
Okay. Yeah, go ahead, Mark. Thanks.
Yeah, essentially you have the gist of it. Is if it's in your contract, if it's required, if it's not in I should say, if it's in the registry agreement contract, it's required. It's not in the registry agreement. It's not allowed.
Right, and I was trying to explain why, and my recollection of why is that because it's not a policy. But ICANN was trying to inspire new GTLD applicants to furnish searchable who is that they awarded an extra point in the evaluation process if they did that. So I think that's the answer. Margie? So Trent said I'm correct, which would be the second time this week. So Margie, go ahead, please.
Sure. I just wanted to agree with Benedict. And it's not just a LEA issue, but it's a issue for commercial companies that are trying to do reverse whois type lookups and do correlation analysis to identify attacks on their platform, their website, or even to identify domain names to include in a lawsuit associated with one particular registrant. And so what's happened since the May 25th is that it's much harder to do that correlation analysis anymore, which is the reason why this particular provision is important and, in our view, should be required as opposed to optional. Because the ability to do the reverse whois lookups from the past is hampered now as a result of the new temporary specification.
Boy, so James, go ahead.
Thanks, Kurt. James speaking, and I think registrars have been fairly consistent in the opposition of making any of this functionality mandatory. I think it is currently optional and should remain so. And look, not seeing the utility of this feature, but I think that we're questioning the legality of offering this, and also the scope of the temporary or the EPVP in converting who is into a pseudo surveillance system by allowing this sort of pivot searches on private data or even pseudo anonymized data. So I think we are fairly consistent in that regardless of the usefulness of this, and I understand there was an ecosystem or cottage industry of providers, third parties providing this data and this function that is no longer able to do so after GDPR, and I think that pushing that responsibility onto contracted parties is outside the scope of this temporary spec. Thank you.
Chris?
Yeah, I just wanted to echo a few of Benedict's points, how important this is to us. And obviously, it's in there at the moment, which is why we agreed to it. I think the GAC as a whole would probably like to firm that up, as some from the BC have also indicated. If we look at some of the other data sets we have access to at the moment, a lot of legal requests that we do, we ask for any associated accounts based on, account numbers or other identifiers. So, it is a fairly standard request. I mean, I think from a data protection and privacy point, it allows some proportionality check to why we're asking for that data, and a necessity of that. So, obviously, certainly sort of European law enforcement would have to provide that to be able to do those requests on any form of data. Thank you.
All right, thanks, Chris. So, to be clear, and I know you understand this, but this appendix section in no way requires search capabilities. It just says where they exist, and then all the other verbiage in that section has to do with narrowly tailoring access to that search capability in order to ensure that the sorts of data disclosures that some people talked about aren't made. So, what this says is where search capability is furnished, you have to be very careful about how it's furnished. So I think there's a couple issues that have been raised here. One is that sections of this are redundant with other requirements, and but it's really a restriction on search where it exists. And then others have raised the issue of whether we should be discussing whether search should be more universal, and whether that's part of the scope of this or not. I'm not sure yet. Alan?
Thank you. Yeah, I'm going in the same direction. Personally, on behalf of ALAC, I strongly support the kind of search capabilities that Margie and Benedict are talking about, but that is, as James said, has been a cottage industry which probably cannot continue to exist, and I'm wondering that even if we required search capability with registrars, is that really the same thing, given that we don't span registrars or registry in any given search? And so I think we need to separate the arguments, and if we need that capability, we need to talk about how it can be obtained for those who have legitimate access. But I'm not sure that falls under the temporary spec. Thank you.
Thanks, Shelley. I think that's a good period on this issue. I'm just reading the chat here. So let me go on to the second paragraph in the second section in the appendix, and paragraphs 2.1 through 2.3, which are on the
on page 17 of your temporary specification, and having to do with when data is restricted and where it touches on, you know, where we're dealing with either registrants or your market is within the EEA or part of your market's within the EEA or data is housed in the EEA. And I think what makes this paragraph controversial really goes back to Section 3 that says, you know, the registrar might apply these requirements where it's commercially reasonable to do so across the board. And so that's what I, in combination with Section 3 of this appendix, that's what I view the issue as being, that the GDPR data restrictions can be applied globally, and it's for registrars to figure out how to, you know, when they touch the EEA, and if it's commercially feasible to parse those restrictions across their registration. My brief understanding of different registrar business models is, in some cases, this is somewhat easily done, and in some cases, it's much, much, much harder to do. So I think that's what the issue is. The issue is, are the data restrictions, can they be applied globally, or just in some way when the EEA is touched? And I think Stephanie brought up in an earlier meeting, and I think Cavus or members of the GAC did too, that, you know, we have to be wary of other privacy regimes that are being implemented in parallel with this one. So that was kind of rambling, but did I capture the issue there, or does somebody want to talk to this one? Come on, I'm still talking. You guys have to talk too. As soon as the joking dies down about the sound, we'll get back to the meeting. I'm going to take that as you start to fade, Alan. You should be an introvert like me. So I think we'll close. So what we have left is, you know, we can go back to this section, these early sections too, but I think we've got a few more sections to go in the appendix, so we'll leave that for next time. Does anybody have any closing comments they want to make? In closing on this substance and this process? And for the, just so I can disclose the mystery to everybody, it was, they were electronic sounds that were made when somebody was trying to close off the call. So all the conspiracy theories were for naught. Cavus?
Yes, if you are still discussing 2.1 to 2.3, there is at least one page of comments by GAC members. Thank you.
Okay. There's at least one page. Can you say that again, Cavus?
I'm saying that if you are still discussing 2.1 to 2.3, in the GAC reply, there is one full page on comments, clarifications with respect to these paragraphs and propose consensus comment to be submitted to, in survey, which is in the by the end of the table 2.1, 2.2, and so on. So these are the things that we need to take on board. Thank you.
Right. Okay. I understand. I'm reading the GAC comment now. Thank you. Mark?
Hey, Grip. This is Mark for the transcript. I guess I just want to make sure I'm clear on where we are and what comes next. So I think I understand you're drawing a line under the, you know, part one of the triage discussion, and we can anticipate that the next meeting we'll move on to part two. But I think, I think, you know, what we're trying to get to is a triage deliverable that we can provide to the GNSO Council as, you know, as sort of our first deliverable. And, you know, your issue summaries are sort of the precursor, I guess, to what that triage document will look like, if I understand correctly. And so I think what might be useful maybe is if, you know, if we were able to see a first draft of maybe part one of the triage discussion. And I think, you know, giving members of the EPDP a chance to look at that and provide feedback, edits, and comments on the email discussion would be a good way to move this forward, and at least let us draw a line under part one and move on to part two. So hopefully, you know, I have that understanding correct, and that's a good path forward.
Great idea. I was actually hoping to have that for this meeting, but I spent 12 hours yesterday in a small moving van collecting furniture from various places and then delivering them to my daughter's apartment where she goes to school. So I couldn't type and drive at the same time very well. So I think, yes, that's exactly my goal, and we'll have something. We're going to amend the issue summaries based on, you know, everything that's been said in our meetings, and then the report will essentially be that green and red thing that we shall not call a scorecard because we don't vote, and then the issue summaries, and then display in you know, some well-organized way everybody's comments. So we'll do that, and we'll, you know, you'll also have the opportunity to amend the comment if that makes sense to you. And so somehow I missed Aiden's attempt at rewording 4.4.8 earlier, so I'll go back and find that. So just to reiterate, the next meeting will be Tuesday at the same time. And it'd be great if part three of the temp spec survey will be submitted Wednesday, essentially close of business. Comments or questions from anybody? Great. Well, thanks very much, everybody. Have a great rest of your day or evening or afternoon. I'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Bye.
And once again, the meeting has been adjourned. Operator Mary, if you could please stop all recordings. To everyone else, please remember to disconnect all remaining lines and have a wonderful rest of your day.